Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. As a nation, our stress levels are on the increase. It's the number one health and safety hazard in the workplace and accounts for nearly half of all working days lost due to ill health. We associate our stress with work and the pressures of adult life, but what about the pressures of childhood? It seems stress is on the increase for kids today as well. Joining me today is Dr. Sam Wass, a developmental psychologist from the University of East London, who studies stress and concentration in children and babies, and who's trying to understand the causes of stress in early childhood. Sam also works on a program that recently stole the nation's hearts, The Secret Life of Four-Year-Olds. It follows the trials and tribulations of a group of children playing, fighting, making friends, breaking rules, and trying to make sense of their place in the social world. Fans of the show will be pleased to hear that a third series is even being filmed this summer. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good morning to you. Now, my first question, I was so intrigued to discover that you were actually an opera director for 10 mm-hmm. years before mm-hmm. going into all this research. What mm-hmm. inspired you to go back to science?
Well, so a variety of different factors. Yeah, so I was working as an opera director. I was working out mainly in kind of the German-speaking world. So I had a job at the Komische Oper in Berlin. I was a staff director there for quite a few years. I think kind of the main factor, which kind of, you know, obviously you think about this quite a lot, kind of in terms of kind of introverts, extroverts. So this is something kind of we notice a lot, and we certainly have kind of talked about quite a lot kind of in the context of the TV show. To be an opera director, you can only work when you're in a room with lots of other people. And I like doing that. I like the kind of the big communication. But I also like spending time on my own and working and being productive on my own. You know, as a scientist, I spend 4 days a week kind of normally at home, actually, kind of analysing my data, kind of writing my papers on my computer. And then you go and present them to a big kind of range of people. And yeah, I really miss that kind of you can't really work on your own as an opera director. So kind of that was one of the big factors. One of the things that's been really nice about doing this, though, and kind of looking out some kind of tapes is kind of exploring the fact that kind of many of the themes that kind of you're interested in, kind of many of the emotional qualities. So I work into stress, I do research into stress. Music is very much about stress. You know, music is all about body rhythms, stress is all about body rhythms. And it's been really, really lovely kind of looking out some pieces that have kind of explored this idea today.
I can't wait. I mean, have you got any opera in your songs?
Yeah, so actually the first piece that I've got coming up is the only one. So we've got lots of really fun, happy, kind of interesting children's music. The first one is actually some kind of quite serious opera.
I'm just going to hold you there.
Okay.
I want to introduce producer Lou behind the desk today, who has a brain teaser for us.
I do. Okay, so for this brain teaser, we're going to use your powers of concentration. So without writing it down, can you tell me how many Fs are in this sentence? Finished files are the result of years of scientific study combined with the experience of years.
I mean, I think that's also a tongue twister.
Yeah, I mean, that was hard to say first thing on a Saturday, I'm not going to lie.
Let's say it once more for our listeners.
Okay.
Count the Fs.
Finished files are the result of years of scientific study combined with the experience of years.
If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio. And for our experiment today, if you want to take part, we are going to be having quite a noisy experiment. We're going to look at how noise stress affects your concentration and your working memory. Now, Sam, back to you and your mm-hmm. first song.
Yeah, so this is some early opera from Monteverdi. So as I say, kind of this is a very serious one. Everything else we've got coming up is very fun. But I thought I wanted to put this in because it illustrates this really interesting point that I was mentioning about how kind of music is built up of patterns, just as stress is built up of patterns. So we know, you know, it's one of the very earliest ideas into what music is, that music is to a greater or a lesser degree kind of expression of kind of the internal rhythms that happen inside us in our body. We know, for example, and we've got good experimental evidence in support of this, that when we listen to music, our heart, to a greater or lesser degree, synchronizes with the pace of the music. So that's why we like to listen to fast-paced music when we're working out and slow-paced music when we're trying to get
I
to sleep.
Spotify is even trying to do something along those lines where it monitors your heartbeat and then suggests songs for it.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. So I'm just getting married. We've been looking through wedding kind of music to put in the ceremony, you know, part during the kind of the church ceremony. And one of the things that's interesting is my fiance. So everything that she's been picking out has been, you know, very even, kind of quite slow paced, but very kind of regular in pace, kind of one metric kind of going all the way through. Whereas I've been picking out music much more like the excerpt that I've picked out, where kind of there are lots of kind of fast surges. So we call it rubato. So parts where the kind of the tempo suddenly increases very rapidly and then slows down again. And my theory on why that is because she's naturally what used to be called a phlegmatic person. You know, she's naturally calmer. She's naturally kind of less, kind of gets less easily worked up, whereas I'm naturally very excitable. So, you know, if I'm stuck in a queue in a traffic jam for 5 minutes, you know, I'm through the roof, and she's like, kind of, why are you getting so worked up? So yeah, so this is a really nice example of the music that I, as an easily work upable type of person, like to listen to. So it's got lots of very fast kind of rapid tempo changes, and it's about a queen kind of singing about her desolation and her confusing and mixed emotions about the fact that she's just found out that her husband is in love with someone else.
The definition of being stressed, experiencing physiological, emotional, or psychological stress, did not appear in the Oxford English Dictionary until 1993.
I think that's crazy. What a modern phenomenon the idea of stress is, or the fact that it's so kind of well used in our vocabulary, and yet it was so late to be into the dictionary. Mm. So stress and childhood, you've said that the levels are increasing. Why do we think that is?
Well, that's a really interesting and complex question. It is a controversial issue. So there are quite a lot of papers out there suggesting that it is. And there are a few papers out there suggesting that it isn't. But if it is, then there are a variety of factors why it might be. So one of the things that kind of I'm looking at kind of in this project, so I've been working on it a bit at Cambridge for the past 3 years, and I'm just moving to East London, where we're looking at it with a very different cohort of babies who are experiencing a very different type of early life living environment. One of the factors is just simple kind of physical noise and chaos and unpredictability in the living environment. And this is one area where we really, really don't have any evidence at the moment. So it seems to us kind of intuitive, and there is some kind of animal research suggesting that when we are kind of exposed to something like a loud noise, our brain reacts differently and our body has a physiological reaction. But this is all very kind of core experimental work, where you take an animal into a lab and you play it a very loud noise and see how it affects it.
And that's what we're going to be doing later. Me and Lou are going to be your lab rats for the day. Have you looked at any of the other differences between kind of childhood now and childhood as it used to be a few decades ago?
Yeah. So one of the other really interesting areas, which I'm very fascinated by, is the fact that, so as we say, you know, we think, although it's slightly controversial, we think that kind of stress is kind of increasing over time. There's definitely really cast iron evidence that IQ is increasing over time. So fluid intelligence, so how good we are at kind of figuring out kind of an unpredictable problem. And they're really quite big increases. So a child who is in the 50th centile now, so an average child now, if you took that same child and you took it, put it into an average classroom in the 70s, that child would be somewhere between the 70th and the 80th centile.
No
so like
way.
Really, you know, really, really quite big differences that a lot of people kind of don't know about. It's a thing called the Flynn effect. It's very, very well established, very, very well kind of replicated.
So each generation has a higher IQ than the generation before, essentially, on average.
Since we started measuring. So we started measuring in the, I think it was the 20s or the 30s. We've been kind of experiencing this effect. So there's a lot of research going into this. It's a very important thing. Kind of there's evidence, for example, that gains are starting to slow down in recent years. There is also kind of evidence that kind of the grains have been stronger for adults than children. And what's really interesting is kind of we can kind of start to use some of these factors to try to explore. It's impossible to tell, you know, because so much has changed in our lives. lives in the past century. So it's really, really interesting and important scientific question to work out kind of why these gains are happening. You know, it could be a whole range of different factors. It could be diet. It could be technology. It could be urbanization. It could be kind of increased lifespan. Really, really important kind of trying to work out why this is a really, really hard scientific question to answer. But we're trying to get there. You know, we're trying to get there from these little cute clues, like, for example, the fact that kind of gains have started to decrease in recent decades. So that's one of the things, you know, technology has kind of gone the other way. So that's one of the factors that suggests that it might, in fact, counterintuitively not be technology that's kind of having such a big role. But the angle that I'm really interested in looking at is this question of kind of, are these two factors related? So if stress and anxiety is increasing and anxiety is increasing too, kind of, are these two things related?
Yeah, because I guess often we see people with higher IQs are more susceptible to stress and anxiety, aren't they?
Well,
it's like that existential argument. The more you kind of wonder about the meaning of your life, the more you stress out about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's always struck me as a very intuitive thing. You know, I was in the Cambridge Neuroscience Department when I was starting to kind of get into this, and, you know, the Cambridge Neuroscience Department is an extremely anxious place. There's a lot of extremely anxious people there. And we were publishing at the time some papers suggesting that kind of are more anxious. So our babies who show bigger stress reactivity are in fact the ones who do better on cognitive kind of assessment. So I was really interested. I spent quite a lot of time kind of looking through the literature. In fact, there's not as much evidence on this question as you'd think. So there are some papers out there suggesting that people with generally higher IQ tend to be more anxious, but really not very many. It's not a very well-established scientific finding. And there's actually some evidence kind of looking at how short-term fluctuations in stress. So when we're at a time when we're at our most stressed relative to our normal stress levels, in fact, we're less kind of, we're certainly less able to plan, probably less able to perform well on an IQ test. So that goes in the other way. So kind of at times when we're more kind of stressed, kind of we're less intelligent, as it were. So it's kind of complex.
So you look at stress and concentration. Mm-hmm. Is a more stressful environment affecting children's concentration, would you say?
So that is another very good question, Matilda. One thing that kind of I'm also really interested in is looking at the auditory environment in schools. So I've got one of my students in East London is an assistant head teacher at a local primary school. And one of the things that she talks about is the lunch hall environment. So, you know, you go into the lunch hall in a school and it's physically uncomfortable how loud it is. You have kind of 200 children talking, no dampening, no acoustic dampening. It's a very kind of echoey, reverberative environment. And, you know, it's physically uncomfortable for an adult to listen to. Children, we know, are much more sensitive to this kind of thing, so the effects on them ought to be much bigger. So anecdotally, she says quite a lot of the teachers, you know, they just say they don't get much done after lunch. You know, they have to teach all the important stuff in the morning. But there really is kind of very little evidence of looking at this kind of in a formal scientific way. So yeah, really interesting stuff to be looking at, I think.
So are you sort of saying that we know a lot about stress in adults, but we haven't actually done very much on the stress in children?
Yeah.
And that's why you're focusing on it.
And the other thing, so there's kind of research into the big kind of psychological risk factors that cause stress. So what we call chronic stress, things like, you know, having multiple parent figures, you know, frequently moving house, having parents from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds who feel themselves very kind of unempowered. So there's research looking at kind of how empowered you feel as a person, you know, and how that affects your body. But what there isn't very much of, which is what I'm very interested in, are these very, very low level factors. So things like kind of noise and chaos and unpredictability in the auditory environment. So yeah, so that's what I'm really, really interested in looking at.
Right. Well, I'm going to move on to this first half of our experiment. So today we are going to look at whether loud noises affect our ability to remember. So IQ is based mainly on tests of working memory. Oh, you want
to say? No, just to be pedantic. So IQ is very strongly associated with, so it correlates very strongly with working memory.
Okay,
which
that's sort of what I meant. I mean, what is intelligence? How do you measure it? It looks like it's very associated with your ability to remember stuff in the short term at the moment. So Sam, I believe you have a list of 10 words that you're going to read out to me and Lou. And just as our control, we are going to see how well we can remember these words after your second song. So if you could read out the first set of words and we'll repeat them back to you. Listeners at home, you should play along too.
Butter.
Butter.
Arm.
Arm.
Shore.
Shore.
Letter.
Letter.
Queen.
Queen.
Cabin.
Cabin.
Pole.
Pole.
Ticket.
Ticket.
Grass.
Grass.
Engine.
Engine. Okay, now listeners at home, while the second song is playing, we want you to be counting backwards from 100 in sevens, just as a little distraction so you can't keep rehearsing those words in your head. Sam, could you introduce the second song, please?
Yeah, so the second song is a piece that I chose as the kind of antithesis, as far away as possible from this kind of very kind of emotionally intense Monteverdi that we had to start with. This is the kind of music that babies love. You put this on and pretty much every baby will kind of burst out into smiles. We've kind of played this to a lot of babies when they come into our labs for testing. And I think the reason is it's exactly the opposite of Monteverdi. So it has a very, very even rhythm. It's very, very regular. It's very, very gentle. It's very, very even. And I think babies love that because babies are naturally very, very up and down in their mood. So they're naturally much, much more like the Monteverdi, kind of lots of fast kind of accelerations and slowdowns. And they just love the fact that this piece we're about to hear, which is called Monkey Music, is so even and so regular and just so happy.
In 1968, John Wayne Mason showed that in order for a situation to induce a stress response, it has to be interpreted as being novel and or unpredictable. It must be threatening to one's ego and or the individual must have the feeling that they do not have control over the situation.
And I think in terms of a noisy environment, that is something you don't normally have control over. Like, you can't go and tell the traffic to shut up or, you know, your neighbours to stop playing really loud music. So I can see why being in a noisy environment could be stressful. So, listeners at home, what we now need to do is see how many of those 10 words we can remember now that we've had a bit of distraction and a bit of lovely monkey music. So me and Lou are going to very quickly jot down how many we can remember and then we shall compare our scores. You want to go first?
Yeah, okay. So engine, ticket, pole, arm, grass and shore.
I got arm, butter, queen, engine, shore and ticket. So I got quite similar. Was that six each?
Yes.
Okay, brilliant. So we got 6 out of 10. Not the best score, but it is very distracting here in the studio. Mm-hmm. Now, we need to do it again. Different list of 10 words. And this time we're going to play a whole bunch of horrible loud noises. So, yeah, make sure it's not too loud or turn the volume up at home to get the full effect. Sam, what's our second list?
Church, coffee, dollar, five, hotel, mountain, cabin, slipper, village.
Okay, right. So again, you've got to count backwards in sevens from 100. But while I play you some horrible road noise. Get that volume right up. Adding in a high-pitched sound for horrible effects. And an alarm. Okay, we're all making pretty tense, horrible faces there in the studio. That was definitely quite stressful to listen to. All right, once again, Lou, we are going to try and see how many of those words we can remember. So the clock starts now. I am really struggling here. I've only got 2 so far. And time's up. Okay, I got 4. Church, queen, pole and slipper. Are those all correct, Sam?
Yeah.
And Lou?
You got the 4 that I didn't get. I got 6.
Go for it.
Cabin, mountain, coffee, hotel, dollar and 5.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah, tricky. So not kind of quite the ideal experiment that I'd like to do for kind of a variety of reasons. So kind of ideally, we would have done compared what is kind of pretty much impossible to achieve in London, certainly at least where we are, which is a completely silent environment as a comparison. So we could be compared kind of a silent environment with a really loud environment. But the other condition that I'd like to have had in there is a kind of a condition kind of with an intermediate level of noise. So to see kind of how that affects us. Another thing that would be nice to do is to kind of pull up out all the different parts of noise. So one of the things that we're really interested in noise is the difference between kind of noise that's constant but continuously flat and noise that, like the construction noise that you played, is very unpredictable. So it has lots of kind of unpredictable increases and decreases. So when we consider noise that's kind of constant but very unpredictable and flat, so something like white noise, so that's just the kind of psh, the noise that you hear, you know, when a radio is tuned between two stations. For that, there is some evidence that for children with ADHD, when it's played up to a moderate intensity, that can actually help to maintain focus in general. So children actually perform better on an impulsive choice task. So kind of looking at kind of their ability to control and to inhibit an urge. They actually perform better at that kind of task when they've got this kind of level of background
noise. That kind of makes sense to me, because I know that I find like low-level music will help me concentrate when I'm studying. And also, if my mind is like whirring when I'm trying to go to sleep, having a really low-level podcast, so that's just at like speech level, it's very similar tones, also helps me.
Definitely, there's a lot of people say, I don't know actually, it's an interesting thing where kind of whether this actually helps babies to sleep, but there's certainly a lot of kind of tubes, kind of videos on YouTube.
Isn't there an argument that it sounds a bit, because the womb is actually a really noisy environment, like you're hearing the sort of whoosh of your mum's body all the time, and that maybe it's soothing because it's just... they've had a lot of noise for those first 9 months.
I mean, one of the things that's interesting in this is kind of when I listen to that, so I listen to kind of white noise a lot, and it's mainly to drown out background noise. So, you know, I work a lot on the train, and when I've got someone having a conversation next to me, kind of I find that it just kind of deafens it. But this study with ADHD was actually comparing it to silence. So they do better under this kind of low level of white noise than they do at silence.
Why do they think that is?
Well... to be honest, Matilda, I was looking through this paper on the way here and trying to follow their explanation. They talk about something called stochastic resonance, and in some way kind of having a low level of activity in the kind of auditory neurons, you know, helps kind of what we call signal to noise ratio. So helps the neurons that kind of choosing to respond to what you want to respond to and not get these kind of false responses. But to be honest, you know, they were going into quite a lot of neuroscientific detail and I didn't follow the detail, but that's the idea. But it's a really interesting stuff. So even compared to complete silence, and this kind of white noise does better. The other thing that I'm really interested in looking at, which to my knowledge there isn't any research into, is whether this optimal level of background noise that we work to, whether that differs between people who are used to being in a kind of loud environment or a quiet environment.
Do you train your mind to shut out that background
exactly.
noise?
Yeah, I certainly notice it, you know, as an urban dweller. It's quite noisy in our house. And I find it very odd going to the country where there's complete silence. So I'd be really interested to get this kind of thing. You know, anecdotally, so I've done quite a lot of work with babies in London and Cambridge, and also kind of in this quite small town, Tampere in Finland. Anecdotally, kind of there's a massive difference, certainly in terms of kind of basic movement levels, what we can see in terms of kind of physiological stress.
Yeah, because you can't measure a baby's memory like we measured. How do you measure their stress responses to noise?
Well, what I noticed with these babies is just simply how much they're moving around the room. So, you know, you took they would bring these babies in from testing in Tampere, which is this small kind of 200,000 city in Finland, and they would just put the baby, and the baby would almost invariably just sit there completely motionless for this first minute that they're in the room, just looking around the room, just working out who's there. London babies, you know, they literally, their bum doesn't hit the floor, they're straight away crawling, you know. Really interesting stuff. Hasn't been investigated formally, but really interesting to look at. Love also to look at kind of these other questions, which is kind of their stress reactivity, as you just mentioned, Matilda. So do London babies have different levels? So we do kind of experiments showing the babies kind of a mild kind of experimental stressor. You know, they used to do this kind of with much more acute stressors in the 70s. We're not allowed to now. So one of the things we do is we show a baby a video of another baby crying, and we measure, you know, how much their body, you know, how much their heart rate changes in response to that.
Okay, so these are the like kinds of things we're allowed to give. Yeah, and temperature and stuff.
Body temperature and something called galvanic skin response, which is the conductivity of the skin. So love to look at, you know, do London babies have different kind of physiological reactions to, you know, Finnish babies? And also love to look at this kind of question of kind of do London babies work best under an intermediate level of background noise and kind of country babies work best in complete silence?
Yeah, that's fascinating. And is it true that you to measure their heart rate, you actually like put it on a bib?
Yeah, so for
that's
this,
so cool. Yeah, so, babies with the heart rate bib.
Yeah, so when we bring them into the lab, we've got kind of a box, and we kind of stick on electrodes, and except we don't call them electrodes to the parents, we call them stickers. to us, we call them electrodes, and we put on a wire, and it basically just measures. You know, it's a completely safe thing that's been used kind of for very long time. You know, it doesn't put anything in. It just measures what's naturally there. It's the same technique, ECG. It's the same technique that they use in hospitals. But for this project that I'm working on at the moment, where we're looking at kind of naturalistic noise, so noise kind of in baby's home environment, we need to be able to do this at home. So we've spent kind of a long time over the past few months kind of designing this little bib that they can wear. So they have three stickers, but that then they put a bunch of clothes on top of that. Everything is miniaturized. So we've got kind of a heart rate monitor and then a body kind of a movement level, a body temperature gauge, but it's all kind of very miniaturized. We've also got a miniature microphone and a tiny little camera. So that records kind of what they can see, and the microphone records what they can hear. And they basically put on this kit. It's all been designed to be very comfortable. They don't realize that they're wearing it because they have to wear it for the whole day. And yeah, so we kind of measure how their auditory environment changes during the course of the day and how their body changes kind of in response to it. We also put the same kit onto the mother so we can look at kind of co-fluctuation, which is another area that I'm hoping to be able to get onto a bit later. So kind of how stress is infectious. So how if I'm in a room and one person's stressed, I become stressed myself. So we're really interested in looking at that kind of co-fluctuation of stress between babies and mothers.
Yeah, fascinating. Mm-hmm. What is song number three?
So song number three is something that I really wanted to get in here because I'm very passionate about it. Kind of, so it's something from Teletubbies. So Teletubbies was made by a company called Ragdoll Productions, who I'm completely obsessed by. I've never met them. I'd really, really love to meet them, but it would be one of those things I'd get very kind of blushy and tongue-tied if I did. So they also make In the Night Garden. We do a lot of bringing babies into the lab to do kind of experiments, looking at things like their concentration. Naturally, kind of these experiments tend to be quite boring and repetitious for babies because we have to kind of do a trial and we have to do the same thing again and again and again, see how they react to it. So in between our experiments, we give them a clip of TV to watch, and we tend to give them, you know, either Teletubbies or In the Night Garden. And so having done this with a lot of babies, watching the expression of delight and sheer unadulterated joy that comes up on the face of very, very many babies when they see this program comes up, got me really fascinated in this question. You know, what is it that these people get so right, that Ragdoll Productions get so right about what kind of babies love to watch? You know, if ever you've sat and watched one of these programs, it's very, very different. It's very, very hard to watch as an adult. You know, adults really kind of yeah, even I don't like kind of watching the program, but babies absolutely love it. I've actually done some research into it, got me interested. So I've done a couple of papers on kind of how they design this so well. You know, the key thing, I think, is that they're very, very good at experiencing a world from a child's point of view. Just to give you a quick example before we get onto the thing. So one of the things that happens all the time in Teletubbies in the Night Garden is just simply, you know, they're halfway through a scene. You know, the Teletubbies will be walking up a hill and then a rabbit will just jump across the screen and the camera will just get distracted by, even though they're in the middle of a story, the camera will just get distracted by the rabbit and then follow the rabbit and then go into a whole story. And it's just so lovely because it's the way children experience the world. You know, they don't experience linear narratives. They're just like, oh, that's interesting and that's interesting. But many, many other levels. So this is the Teletubbies theme music, just as testament to Ragdoll Productions, who I think are a really, really brilliant group of people.
Time for Teletubbies. Time for Teletubbies. Time for Teletubbies. Time for Teletubbies.
Dinky Winky.
Hinky Winky.
Dipsy.
La
la.
La la.
Po.
Po.
Teletubbies.
Teletubbies.
Say hello. Dipsy, la la, ho, Teletubbies,
Teletubbies,
big ha.
Through generations, stress has effectively enhanced human survival because of its specific traits that jog your wakefulness and develop bodily functions.
Now, I was dying to ask you what it's been like working on Secret Life of Four-Year-Olds, because that has to be one of my favourite programmes on TV. It's just incredible being able to watch like a young child's reactions up close and how they kind of process things and make decisions and work out what's right and wrong and who to be friends with. It's just so wonderful to watch.
No, it's been a really, really wonderful experience to work on. I've enjoyed it so much and I've learned so much from it. Yeah, so kind of the way, so I was involved right from the beginning. The kind of the pilot show that we made, we started off kind of just making a 10-minute segment because Channel 4 were kind of not at all convinced that this was possible. The pilot show was kind of, we were observing children naturally in the nursery and then taking them into a room one by one and doing kind of famous experiments from the history of child psychology on them to look at kind of the relationship between how they performed in these kind of experiments and in the nursery. From the kind of early feedback from the channel, kind of they thought that was good, but they just wanted the nursery and to integrate the kind of the experiments kind of in. So that's what we kind of ended up doing. Mm. We're there every minute that they're filming, you know, two of us in a room kind of on site, but kind of not directly seeing the children, looking on kind of a series of monitors and kind of with a radio mic. Each of the children is wearing a radio mic and we can listen to them. So one of the things that's been really, really amazing and instructive is just because we have this kind of incredibly kind of, it feels very intimate, even though we're never actually in the same room as them. But you can very close up on their faces, you know, the producers always like to kind of focus on the kind of the children's hands and their bodies, you know, all those kind of hidden markers of kind of how the child's really feeling. And also because you're on the mic, you can really hear them breathing and you can hear kind of how their body kind of is functioning kind of through their breath. So one of the things you really get is just how up and down, you know, how intense life is as a child. As a four-year-old child, they'll be best friends with someone and then they'll be worst enemies and they'll be so upset, you know, and their body is really singing, you know, I'm really upset. And then within, you know, 20 minutes they've calmed down and they're best friends again, and they just live this incredibly melodramatic, you know, operatic kind of life, you know, through the day, which has been really, really instructive to me. You know, it's one of the things that's got me really interested in kind of what causes these changes. You know, there's a whole bunch of kind of interesting stuff I've noted, for example, on, you know, what it is about environment, what particular environments kind of tend to kind of make these kind of mood changes more acute versus more calm. But one of the things, the really big thing that kind of I've taken is using this kind of understanding of just how up and down children are in terms of kind of their physiological stress as a way of understanding kind of naughty behaviours. So what, you know, just to give you an example, a four-year-old child will go up to another child and, you know, the child is playing with a toy, and rather than, you know, playing nicely or doing something together, they'll just go up and try and snatch the toy off the other child. Mm. The teacher, kind of any teacher, will react to that in pretty much the same way, taking the child away from the others and explaining to that child that it's nice to share. Yeah, what's really interesting, yeah, when you get to
sharing is caring,
yeah, what's really interesting when you get to know these children well is you can see a child who, you know, understands this point. You know, you've seen this child say, you know, sometimes a couple of hours earlier that day, sharing is caring or sharing is nice, sharing make friends. You know, you've seen that child remonstrating with another child, you know, so that child understands intellectually that it's nice to share, that sharing is going to get them praise, that sharing is going to help them make friends. And yet they're not doing it. So why is that? Because emotionally, they're at a state where they've lost control of their behavior. You know, children are very up and down in their moods, and very often they spend much, much more time out of control of their behavior than adults do. We all experience it, you know, as adults, some more than others, a mood just takes over as we lose control. Children experience that state far more often than adults do. And that's really interesting in terms of kind of how we interact with children, you know. So we naturally have a very, almost kind of, I describe it almost like an Asperger's, like, you know, if the child isn't behaving in the way that kind of in a good way, it must be because that child, from a really cold, calculating, intellectual perspective, doesn't understand what good behavior is. Yeah. And in fact, you know, I would say kind of a lot of the reasons for good behavior are very different, you know, not to do with intellectually not understanding, but more to do with the fact that that child has lost control of their moods at the time. And I think that's a really, really important point that has massive implications, yeah, you know, for a lot of the time, the ways in which we interact with children.
And I think, yeah, it makes perfect sense, because that's kind of what growing up is. You know, you have your tantrums when you're little. Mm-hmm. You have your mood swings as a teenager, and really, mm-hmm, the hallmark of being an adult is you're expected to control your emotions and behave appropriately in the situations. And obviously not everyone does all the time.
Yeah, some more than others. My family perhaps less than other families, but yeah.
But exactly, like, as a, you know, if I suddenly threw myself on the studio floor and kicked and screamed because, yeah, you know, something had gone a little bit wrong, or I hadn't gotten ice cream or whatever, that would be completely inappropriate. But yeah, with a child, you do understand that they don't have that control yet.
Yeah. At the same time, though, you know, it's not just simply a question of kind of the the best state is the no emotion state. So there's a lot of other research, which is also kind of a big part of my research that we haven't talked about so much, about kind of the idea that kind of the optimal state is not a no stress state. The optimal state, so we actually learn best at kind of intermediate states of stress. And there is some research kind of being kind of to a degree kind of up and down, so being more reactive to things is can help us to learn. So yeah, so this is actually kind of, this has been formalized as a theory. It's called the kind of formally it's called differential susceptibility theory. Colloquially, it's called the dandelions and orchids theory.
Oh my god, I love this theory. I've heard of it too. Yeah, it's so interesting.
No, it's a really interesting one that, yeah, so I'm doing quite a lot of research into, and I actually managed to get it into the first episode of series two. We featured this quite prominently. And yeah, so just to give you an example of kind of what got us interested in this, this is kind of how different children react to the same experience in different ways. So the way for series two, the way that the outdoor play space was set up, we had a kind of a Wendy house, and it had some steps going up to the Wendy house, and something about the geography of it meant that children, there was a long path and children could see, when children are making friends, like everybody, kind of one of the techniques that they use to make friends is by excluding someone else. You know, you wish they didn't because it leads to so much upset, but you know, it's a natural thing that we do when we're trying to make friends. We shut someone out as a way of kind of giving ourselves something to bond over. So one of the things that we saw happen quite a lot in the first couple of days for this week was two children would be in the Wendy house playing. They would see another kid coming and they would say, let's stop that person coming up. Yeah, it's just going to be us two in the Wendy house. So we had four children who experience basically in this identical experience of they tried to go up the steps to the Wendy house. A couple of children who they didn't know very well were at the top and they stopped them coming. And it was fascinating how these four children responded to the experience in such different ways, you know. Mm. So one, you know, just kind of turned down, had no reaction, carried on and went off played with something else, played with some other children. Another one kind of wailed you know, the teacher came over and said, what's wrong? And then they said they won't let me play in the Wendy house, and then it was resolved and that child kind of showed no long-lasting thing. One child really internalized the experience, you know, was in quite a bad kind of low mood, you know, and I think his father said that he'd been thinking about it kind of at the end of the day. And one child really experienced it and spent a long time thinking about it and, you know, was trying to clearly trying to figure out kind of what it was about those other
why
children they didn't
rejected,
like.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So this, we thought, was an interesting thing in terms of kind of looking at different levels of sensitivity in children, yeah? So how some children are naturally kind of sensitive to things and some children are naturally less sensitive, yeah? And the naturally less sensitive children are, according to this theory, the dandelion children. So dandelion is a flower that will grow anywhere. And
yeah,
it's
we think of it as a weed, don't we?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, but they're kind of, they're very happy.
Doesn't need
they will
any
grow
watering.
Anywhere, yeah.
It just sprouts wherever it wants.
Mm-hmm. And the sensitive children, the ones who show a big reaction to something like getting shut out of the Wendy house, are called the orchid children. So an orchid is a very beautiful flower that only grows if it's in the right environment. And the thing about the orchid children, and it's really the really interesting thing is, if these orchid children, these very sensitive children, are raised in the best environments, yeah, in a good supportive environment, those are the children that show the best outcomes. So they kind of show kind of the best kind of educational kind of long-term kind of life outcomes. But if those same more sensitive children are raised in a bad, unsupportive environment, they're the ones who show the worst outcomes. So dandelions are kind of always somewhere in the middle, whether they're raised in a supportive environment or not, whereas the orchids are either kind of top of the class or bottom of the class, depending on their supportive environment.
This is what I found fascinating, because everyone kind of knows the idea of, oh, like, if you have kind of traumatic experiences early in life or a difficult home environment or whatever, then it's going to impact negatively on your learning and your abilities at school and all of that kind of stuff. But it's that flip side of the coin, which is actually, if you're in a really good supportive environment, then if you are very sensitive to that environment, you will thrive on everything you're being given, and you'll almost absorb it more than a dandelion child, and really you will accomplish like the best. Be your best self.
It's a really interesting, it's really, really interesting and obviously kind of very important kind of area. So, you know, as a scientist, you know, you can, the immediate question is, well, what is this idea of sensitivity? You know, we've been talking about it in a very kind of colloquial way. So sensitivity is defined by people investigating the dandelions, orchids in very different ways. You know, so some talk about it in terms of a gene, kind of a, you know, there's lots of research into kind of dopamine genes. There is some, a lot of, in fact, the majority of research into this kind of looks at kind of sensitivity from a genetic point of view. there is some research looking at it from a temperament point of view, so kind of the kind of questionnaires that we can give to look at mood in children. I'm very interested in this from the physiological point of view. So do we get, you know, big heart rate changes to things like an experimental stressor? So I would be predicting that kind of the children, you know, when they had the Wendy House experience, would be showing a big heart rate change to it. In fact, kind of, and this is, I'm just writing kind of the next kind of 5-year research project. And in fact, from the physiological point of view, this is an area where the jury's still out. So the question is kind of, do we have one stress system? So do we have one physiological sensitivity system? So do children who show a big, you know, physiological change to something bad happening, like getting shut out of the Wendy House, are they the same children who also show a big physiological change when something interesting happens? So we know that kind of women
So do they get very upset, but also very excited?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So do we have kind of big things? So is it one, do we have one kind of physiological sensitivity system, or do we have some children who will respond more to a bad thing but wouldn't respond so much to
so
a good
have, like,
thing, and others who respond lots
and
to
a
good.
Positive system.
Exactly, yeah. So that's one of the areas, you know, where the jury's still out. So we kind of had been expecting to find kind of one system, you know, based on differential susceptibility theory. In fact, we've had some evidence, you know, from our Cambridge data that is still kind of coming out, suggesting that in fact kind of it might be more like two different systems. But yeah, jury's still out on that one.
Ah, watch this space. Sam, what is song number 4?
Okay, so this is a song that's very simple, kind of aspirational. You know, this is, I'm more like the Monteverdi, I'm more kind of up and down in my mood. This is what I'd like to be like. This is De La Soul, 3 Feet High and Rising.
3, that's a magic number. Yes, it is. It's the magic number. 3. Somewhere in this hip hop soul community was born 3, laced up in me, and that's a magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music raises 3 parts. Casually see but don't do like the soul. Cause seeing and doing are actions for monkeys. Doing hip hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a punk. Parents let go cause it's magic in the air. Criticizing rap, cause you're out of order.
A common way to measure stress is to look at levels of cortisol, known as the stress hormone, in your body, normally in your saliva. But a new assessment is being developed to measure the cortisol that accumulates in your hair. The cool thing about this is that it measures your cortisol over time. 3 centimeters of hair will show your stress levels of the last 3 months.
Science.
News just in. New internet on the horizon as Chinese satellite sets record for quantum entanglement.
Have you ever wanted to walk on the beach instead of having to have a checkup at the dentist? Well, now you can do both.
The prevalence of depression in adolescents and young adults has increased in recent years.
A new chemical triggers fake tan and gives you extra protection from the sun.
Scientists discover the secrets behind ladybird wings and are excited for the potential scientific advances.
The number of television hours viewed daily was associated with more fidgetiness, a sign of hyperactivity, which in turn was related to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Boom! Wow. High five to us. So I'm so excited about this, especially because it's such a good news story for the summer. So this new chemical that triggers fake tan, it's not fake, it's actually a real tan. And the way it's working is that because obviously people with different skin tones will tan different amounts, the colour in your skin is caused by a pigment called melanin. And there's a gene called MC1R. And with people who don't tan very well, so people who have red hair, that gene doesn't really turn on. And so they don't produce melanin in response to the sun. But what scientists have found is a new molecule called SIK. And that can override the MC1R and turn on the melanin-producing pigments, meaning that you can create olive skin in someone who might have red hair and doesn't naturally have that. And having a skin tan is one of the best ways to protect ourselves from UV radiation. So it is one of the best forms of defense against eventually getting skin cancer. Obviously, sunblock is good as well. But if you have naturally dark skin, you're way more protected. So this is just like super exciting advances towards protecting people from skin cancer. Although I'm going to give it a caveat with that it's only so far been tested on skin samples in the lab and mice, but it's really, really promising and one to look out for in the future. Lou, tell me about your story.
I mean, have you ever wanted to walk on the beach instead of having a checkup at the dentist? So obviously, as we know, going to the dentist can fill us all with anxiety and stress, a common topic for today. So basically, that's why a group of scientists, they decided to test 70 patients. They split them into three groups. They had one sort of standard care. And then for the two test groups, they decided to introduce virtual reality technology. And so they had one group sort of going through a virtual reality urban experience and one group going through a virtual reality beach experience. And they wanted to see if this would have an impact on the level of anxiety they were experiencing whilst at the dentist. Very interestingly, those who were shown the beach virtual reality scenes, they felt much less anxious in the actual checkup. And then they were also asked again 2 weeks later, and it turns out that their anxiety levels were still low. And obviously, sometimes people might think about going to the dentist and they might just start getting a bit worked up, but it appears to have had quite a positive impact overall.
That's so interesting. So yeah. even a virtual nature environment could reduce your stress levels.
It's amazing. It doesn't work on everyone, apparently. And they definitely want to do more tests. But I think that's amazingly cool. Can you imagine like going to the dentist and not even have to be at the dentist? You just be there like, oh, I'm at the beach, or, you know, whatever sort of really cool. Maybe you could be in a nice rainforest with some birds chirping.
And then a bird pulls out your tooth.
yeah, maybe.
It also kind of fits in with what we've been talking about.
That's what I was thinking about, noises. Yeah.
Noises and environment.
It's interesting.
And do we know of any other methods that are proven to reduce stress? I know I've read some stuff on how touch, like having a hug or someone holding your hand, just having some physical contact can help to reduce stress symptoms in your body.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting area. So there's research that parents who touch their children more tend to have calmer children. But also there's some stuff kind of suggesting that even simply just having the parent just touch the child lightly on the upper arm before they do like what we call a threat bias test. So we show them kind of some threatening images and we show them some unthreatening images and we see how much they look at the threatening images. You know, so they're kind of short-term effects of touch. So there's music and there's singing in particular. So, you know, singing's good because it forces your body to breathe as if you're calm. You know, emotions
are... Breath is really important, isn't it?
Yeah, emotions are kind of our brain trying to interpret what's happening in our body. So tricking our body to thinking that we're calm by forcing ourselves into this kind of very slow, regular breathing pattern, such as we do when we're singing, is a good way of calming down. There's obviously kind of psychological factors, you know, mindfulness, kind of, you know, affect mirroring, you know, so with the child, you know, back to the example of the child, you know, who's too stressed and goes up and snatches a child off another child, you know, simply saying to that child, kind of, I can understand that it's very upsetting, kind of, when, you know, whatever is upsetting that child, you know, it's amazing to see the expression on the child's face, it kind of, because children to an amazing degree are unaware of the emotions that they're feeling when they're feeling. We've discovered that a lot by trying to interview them about what they're feeling, and they're just like, I don't know.
Not self-aware.
They just don't understand their own emotions. Yeah. So just some kind of simply kind of mirroring an emotion back to a child is a very good way of kind of helping them. You know, this is kind of mindfulness very extensively
researched. So they're kind of like really like upset and uptight, but they don't understand why.
And there's no reason why they should. You know, how do you know what an emotion is unless you get taught what an emotion is? You know,
that's not so true. It's not like a dog knows its emotions.
Yeah, a dog.
Yeah, I was just thinking of animals that like wouldn't have a concept of emotions.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's that. And then the other thing which I'm really interested in that I'm really, really hoping to kind of look at more in future is the opposite of that. So kind of things that we do to wind each other up, you know. So we all know, you know, colloquially, it's one of the things that kind of anxiety is infectious. You know, if you're in a room and there's one person kind of who's tense, you know, how does that tension kind of transmit itself to one another? You know, as I mentioned, we're going to be looking at this kind of co-fluctuation of stress levels between a parent and child, you know, how they do that, you know, really interesting stuff to do in the family. And also, of course, you know, one of the things, you know, getting onto this kind of, if we are getting more stressed and anxious, kind of, why is this, you know, interpersonal transmission of anxiety, you know, through social media, you know, so anxiety, you know, we've all seen kind of anxiety spread around Twitter, you know, kind of how does this kind of anxiety kind of
spread? Definitely that idea that if you just like turn off your phone and sort of D-zone from the internet for a bit, you can calm yourself down.
Yeah. So kind of, but really interesting kind of to look at that, you know, what's the flip side of that? So how do we kind of take the good sides of that without kind of, you know, getting away from that kind of negative kind of side effect?
Now, I'm really sad to say we are massively running out of time here. So Sam, you're going to have to pick one story and you've got about 2 minutes.
One song?
One story.
Oh, okay.
One new story.
That we're talking about. Yeah. Yeah, so the story that I'll go for is more kind of the stuff on TV. So there's lots of kind of papers out there kind of on this, you know, a big paper came out in 2002 that had massive kind of splash findings about, you know, watching TV is associated with poorer concentration in children. It's a really interesting area. It's very, very hard to do good science on, and because there's massive kind of, you need a clean comparison sample, and it's impossible to get a clean comparison sample. You know, families where children watch a lot more TV tend to differ on many aspects, many other parameters. Yeah. You know, they tend not to feed their children so well, tend not to spend so much time, you know, have so many books and that, etc., etc. Exactly. That's another big factor, yeah, how much time you spend talking. So very, very hard to separate out these factors. I mean, one thing that kind of we've just doing an experiment on, we've got a kind of a paper under review at the moment on kind of looking at children's physiological reactions to something like an iPad game. And there is some previous research on this as well. So iPad games often put us in simulated danger, you know, just as we were hearing about going to the dentist, you know, when there is some research suggesting that when we are in simulated danger, our body responds as if it's in real danger. So our same kind of sympathetic fight or flight nervous system kicks in, even if we're not physically in danger. So we've got some evidence on that, you know, in children in simulated danger. So yeah, so that might be having an effect, you know, but lots more research needs to be done on this.
That's so interesting. I wish we could talk longer. Like, there's everything you've said, I have like 10 questions I want to ask, but okay. Sadly we are drawing to the end of our hour. So for your final song, and I've made you pick between two, I'm very sorry. What are we having and why?
So this is just simple fun. This is some gorgeous stuff from my time when I was living in Germany. This is the German version of Sesame Street. And it's just a very, very silly song that I actually genuinely listen to quite a lot. We had some people around for dinner and I put this on as background music. And my fiance was like, Sam, you can't play this when you've got people around. It's a really cool song. I really love it.
Ich schließ die Augen und entdecke, was das mir fremd ist und wunderbar. Keins der Monster kommt und verdirbt mir das. Nur was ich will, ist für mich da.
Leicht wie die schönen Luftballons entschweben, frei aus meiner Fantasie. Kann ein jeder für sich was Schönes erleben und Angst belästigt ihn.
Durch die Bäume und der Mond scheint brav wie ein Schaf.
Doch am schönsten ist's noch inmitten meiner Kuschelträume, wenn ich.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.